This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Our political system was designed to put some power in the hands of the governed. Elections let us hold leaders accountable and raise our collective voice. And we all know how that actually plays out at election time. The highway median disappears under a blanket of campaign posters, and teens with clipboards wander the streets. YouTube cat videos are prefaced with grave accusations of white men committing fraud. Democrats are revealed to be socialist, Republicans shown to be fascist, and the air smells of pumpkin spice. And then we head down to the Baptist church to feed our sacred box the paper in the hope that it will accept our offering and come to accept the idea that the majority rules and the losers can, well, deny the results and throw millions of dollars of dark money into local elections, shut down the federal government out of spite, and that is what we call the American way. But is it the only way? Well, let's spend the day thinking outside the ballot box. We're going to hear about alternatives, including the Tuscarora matriarchy, ranked choice voting, and leaders elected by lottery. I'm here with two elections experts. Rosemary F. Blizzard is communications director for the Ranked Choice Voting Resource Center, also a former director for the Wayne and Duplin County Boards of Elections. Thanks for joining us, Rosemary.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Alex Guerrero is also on the line, an associate professor of philosophy at Rutgers University. His forthcoming book is called Lotocracy, A New Kind of Democracy. Hello, Alex.
Hello.
Let's get some definitions and some sense of the ground that we're walking on before we try to figure this out and agree on what it is we're aiming for. So it might seem a little goofy, but I'm going to ask each of you to come up with three words to describe the ideal government. Rosemary, I'm going to start with you.
No pressure. integrity, honest, and transparent.
Okay, Alex?
That's a good question. So I like transparent. I like responsive. And I think fair.
All right, so I think those are all good, and you can move on to the lightning round now. That's all great. So with that as kind of a starting point, and I think a lot of people would agree with that, let's ask how close you are or how close our system comes to meeting those. Alex, how close or how far are we from actually having a government that represents those, or a system that achieves those goals?
Well, I think we're doing pretty well most of the time in terms of transparency. I worry a lot about both responsiveness and fairness. So I think often we get political decisions and political outcomes that don't really reflect what, you know, we prefer and value and what's in our interests. I think there's a lot of capture by special interests of various kinds. And I think there's a lot of unfairness in the system. I think it matters a lot who you are, what your resources are, that really shifts how much influence you have, starting with, you know, the media and the way people understand the political world, but then also going all the way down to who's viable as candidates for office, who they have to get money from, and all of that as well.
All right, so what's responsible for that? Do you think it's really kind of baked into the system, or is the system not functioning the way it was meant to do if it's not as responsive as you say it should be? What's responsible for that?
Well, I mean, I think part of the problem is just the size and scale and scope of the problems that we face, that we really need political institutions to help us address, has just become overwhelming. So most people don't know enough about most of the issues to really hold their representatives accountable, to really understand, you know, what policy would be best with all manner, you know, different topics, whether healthcare or agriculture or whatever it might be. People might have pockets of knowledge, but not enough to really hold their representatives accountable. And in the absence of that, they can, you know, sort of sell a good game to us. They can kind of manipulate us in various ways. And we feel like we have this illusion of choice. We get to pick between A and B every 2 or 4 or 6 years. But I think often the people we pick don't then go on to do things that really help solve the problems that we face.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that, because I think you can also talk about the illusion of scale. Absolutely everybody knows what problems they are facing, and they understand them quite well. But as you point out, the way they're framed both in the media and by the candidates, can give one a sense of helplessness. So I do want to come back to that idea. Rosemary, to the extent that you, you know, you laid out your three principles for good government, how close are we and what's in the way of achieving those goals?
I don't think we're as close as I would like for us to be. I will agree with Alex. I think we do a pretty decent job of transparency. The individuals who are responsible for keeping our government running, I think, do a good job overall. When it comes to honesty, you know, honesty is a little bit kind of like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. One of the things that, you know, my opinion comes from that of being not only involved in elections and ranked choice voting, but also as a mother and a voter is, you know, the internet is all of the issues that we're faced with, that we're tasked with as voters to decide the best candidate to handle those issues. You know, we've got so many different places, sources of information, and there is no control over how honest that information is. And, you know, we've really, I think, got to emphasize digital literacy going forward with not only our children, but with everyone who has access to a ballot box. So I've got some issues as to how we are allowing where we're getting our information from and how we disseminate that information and what skills we have forward.
Let's talk more about that because, again, I think it gets back to this issue of framing. So I'm going to stick with you, Rosemary, then go back to Alex. If you accept my premise that everybody knows what's bothering them and everybody knows the issues that matter to them, and somehow when we read about them, whether they get atomized through social media or aggregated in traditional media, mass media, somehow they're unrecognizable. And some aspect of my problem is in there, but it's not the way it's being framed. How is it that we lost control of that? And I'll start with you, Rosemary, because you said we need media literacy. What would that look like? How would we tell the media and tell the candidates, you're not talking about what matters to me?
Well, I mean, that's... I don't know that we'll ever be able to have that conversation as far as with having it with candidates. I come at it from critical thinking skills, being able to disseminate, you know, the source of this information is coming from a very specifically aligned group of opinions. And is that the only place I should get my information from? I have a 15-year-old who is learning to navigate these waters called the internet, and he would come to me because he knows, oh, mom's been an elections director, so she should know, and he would come to me with all these questions about the Electoral College and what happened, you know, on Tuesday. And, you know, my first question was, where are you getting this information from? Show me your source. And we've really got to start pushing that with everyone, whether it be voters, children, elected officials. What is your source? Identify that motivation for speaking the way that you do, writing articles the way that you write them, and demanding that you present as wide a picture as possible, and stop narrowing it down to one issue. You know, we've got a lot of single issue voters, and we really got to get away from that if we can.
Well, Alex, that certainly speaks to media literacy and fact-based reporting and understanding. Let's also take a look at this framing issue. If I'm in a rural area and I don't have a hospital near me, and I've noticed that a lot of the medical care I had a generation ago is gone, my problem is people are dying, people are sick in my community. And then if suddenly we talk about solutions as socialism and the socialists are communists and the communists killed 6 million people in the 20th century, all of that's accurate, but it may or may not be, again, germane to the issue that I'm facing. And that becomes a framing issue, not even an accuracy issue. Would you say, and is there a way to address that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we really see, I mean, you started with the idea that we do know what bothers us. You know, in our day-to-day, we know what we're stressed about, whether it's our job or our healthcare or, you know, sexism in the workplace or safety or health or whatever it might be. We might have a sense of what those issues are, but there's often then a mismatch between what the kind of federal election discussion is about, what we're actually paying attention to when we turn on the TV, And some of that, I think, is because we scale things up too much. There's too much attention at the federal level, not enough kind of at the local and state level, both with the news and the kind of political attention. But I think, you know, a bigger problem too is, you know, goes back to Walter Lippmann writing in the 1920s and then later Neil Postman writing in the 70s and 80s. He's got this great book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And the basic idea is that the way we consume information, the way we seek out the news to learn about the political world, it's entertainment for us of a kind. Like, we don't try to do the hard work of really understanding things. So we might have a kind of superficial understanding of the problems that we face. We don't necessarily know what's causing them and how we might solve them. That's why we want, you know, elected representatives or representatives to work on those problems, to learn about them. But when we go and pay attention to the news, you know, we just want to kind of follow our team and root for our team and hear about the bad guys on the other side. And very little of it gets into the details of policy. It's a lot focused on personalities. We hear about, you know, in the 2016 election, it was all about migrant caravans. You know, that was all of a sudden everybody's biggest problem in the world. And, you know, that's just, to my mind, you know, media manipulation to keep our eyeballs glued to the TV set, things that frighten us rather than helping us really think about our problems. So I do agree with Rosemary about the media literacy part. I think it's really important.
And much easier to do when you're locked in a binary where there's one side and another. It's much easier than the complexity of other systems and other ways of approaching it. We'll get into those alternatives when our program continues with Rosemary Blizzard, Communications Director for the Ranked Choice Voting Resource Center, and Alex Guerrero, who is a philosophy professor at Rutgers University. We're talking about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. With over a decade of most citizens disapproving of Congress that we elect, maybe it is time to think about a different way of choosing our leaders. We're talking about alternatives and reforms to the electoral system today. Philosophy scholar Alex Guerrero and a former County Board of Elections director in Wayne and Duplin counties, Rosemary Blizzard, is on the line talking about alternatives. Rosemary, one of the alternatives that you talk about is ranked choice voting. Tell us what that is.
In its most simplest definition, you know, when you go vote right now, you have to pick one. And sometimes you have to hold your nose to do it. And with ranked choice voting, rather than just getting a list of candidates and picking one, we're asking voters to rank candidates in terms of their first, second, third, however many choices there may be. And what that does, or what we've seen happen with that, is, you know, it tends to decrease contentious campaigns. If I cannot be your first choice, please let me be your second choice. With the use of ranked choice voting, it can eliminate very expensive primaries and runoff elections. Georgia right now is getting ready to do two runoffs for Senate. With ranked choice voting in November, it's possible that they wouldn't have had to do that. And the citizens of Georgia wouldn't be looking at two more months of campaigning.
It seems a little like to see it explained, it seems like a complicated formula. Here's my first choice, here's my second, here's my third. We'll look at how many people got enough first choice votes. If they didn't get enough, we then move to a process to start considering second choice votes. It feels complicated. Is it, or is it just hard to describe?
Complicated in terms of navigating the ballot. Overwhelmingly, North Carolina actually had a ranked choice voting election in 2010. They were the first state since the 30s to conduct a statewide election. It was called IRV, or instant runoff voting. You hear it called that sometimes. There is some nuances of the tabulation aspect that can become very in the weeds, depending on how the rules are set up. But ideally, you know, right now, if we were to hold a ranked choice voting election and someone were to get 50% or better of the first choice votes, then the election is over. The only time that you would incorporate additional counting would be if no one gets the majority of the vote. There is a little more math involved. but it is not exceedingly complicated.
In terms of the tabulation, any greater security risks in terms of transparency and our confidence in the system?
I don't think there should be. We would, you know, in a ranked choice voting election on election night, you would announce the first round of votes the same way we announce unofficial results as we currently have. And then, of course, just like the county boards of elections are doing right now and have been doing since Tuesday, you would incorporate any remaining absentee ballots that needed to be counted or provisional ballots that needed to be reviewed. And then you would run the tabulation for the ranked choice voting election, any additional rounds that might be necessary. And, you know, a lot of people, when we start talking about those things, they're like, oh my God, I've got to buy new equipment, and that's going to be outrageously expensive and complicated. And, you know, most of the major vendors in the United States that sell voting equipment, we have been working with them directly to either, you know, help them develop their equipment to handle ranked choice voting tabulations. In the absence of that, the Ranked Choice Voting Resource Center, working with a group of programmers out of Bay Area in California, have developed a ranked choice voting tabulator, which would allow us to take the cast vote record, not the ballots themselves, but the cast vote record, which is a fancy term for a really complicated spreadsheet that the equipment would generate. And we can tabulate ranked choice voting election in seconds.
Well, so tell us about what the other virtues. I mean, on the one hand, okay, it eliminates primaries. What are some of the other virtues?
Well, for me as a voter, the two biggest ones are the elimination of an expensive primary. What a lot of people don't realize in a runoff situation or a second primary, whether one person shows up to vote or 10 million show up to vote, the processes are still the same and the cost reflects that. So getting rid of that extra cost would be amazing when we are obviously strapped revenue-wise. The other is that it tends to foster more cooperation between candidates and less that guy's an idiot and that guy did, you know, this 10 years ago, and don't vote for him for that reason. So it does.
Would it break, forgive me for interrupting, mm-hmm. but would it break
yeah,
the lock
no
of
problem.
The part of party control? Does it allow for more people to enter the process, or do the parties still dictate who our choices are?
There are those that do believe, and there is some evidence that supports that ranked choice voting would be a bit more receptive to a third party candidate. It does help with what research shows is it does help break the spoiler effect idea. You know, we sometimes will have a third party candidate come in and take enough of the percentage of the vote, maybe not to win, but to dilute the strength of another candidate in the major party. When you start ranking candidates, you get a little less of that.
Well, let's talk about other alternatives, because mm-hmm. I know, Alex, you are writing a book now about a lottery system, which has been tried and true. It's an ancient system, and it's also being used in various parts of the country. But tell us how that system works.
Well, so there's a number of different parts, different ways of doing it. So, I mean, all the way back to ancient Athens and the birthplace of democracy, you had the use of random selection, where some people from the community would be picked at random to serve in political office. And currently it's been used, you know, all around the world to focus on particular issues, constitutional reform, electoral reform, whether or not to build, you know, a new hydroelectric dam or power plant somewhere. So very focused questions where people would be chosen at random from the political community, like any kind of lottery, maybe 100, 200, 300 people, depending on, you know, the issue and the size and scope.
And do I, let me interrupt you there. Do
sure,
I identify
sure.
myself as a candidate, or do I just go to the phone book? Remember those? Phone book.
Yeah. No, it's just ideally everybody, you know, of 18 years and older would be in the system, and any of them might be chosen. So it's not that you have to kind of volunteer yourself. In that way, it'd be somewhat like jury duty or something like that, sort of using that kind of selection method. And then you'd be, you know, chosen at random. Ordinarily, you wouldn't know very much about the issue yet. And so you'd be basically the way these have often been structured. There's a kind of learning phase where for a month or two, you learn about the issue, you learn about the particular question that you're being asked to consider. Then you often, at least under the system as I envision it, there'd be a kind of period of public engagement and consultation. And then, you know, the randomly selected citizens would come up with a proposal. And on the system, as I argue for it, they could then enact that directly. On other alternatives, you could then put that up to a referendum vote of the whole political community, but sort of bypassing the use of elections entirely.
Does this now, work? Does this work beyond the local level, where you can kind of, you know everybody kind of personally, and the issues are much more imminent?
Sure. I mean, I think it could. The way it's been used, so like, for example, in Ireland, they were considering constitutional reforms of various kinds. And so in particular, the question of whether to make abortion legal at any point, whether to allow same-sex marriage. So as part of that process, they chose at random, you know, a significant number of citizens and had them come together and talk about the issues. Now, you know, those are topics that everyone has an opinion about, but they were hearing from people they really disagreed with. And I think some of that can really break down some of the kind of us versus them dynamic. On other issues, something might be, you know, much more technical or complicated, like whether you have a, you know, new nuclear power plant built or a hydroelectric, you know, system put in place. Ordinary citizens might not have a very clear view about the pros and cons there. But so in some cases, you might bring people together, have them learn about the issue, learn about the different pros and cons, hearing from experts and, you know, in some cases, people from industry, but having to disclose their biases.
But that sounds like, forgive me for interrupting, but that does sound like you want to then have these elections around issues rather than positions. So you're not going to select your mayor or your president that way. But if you have a particular issue that you'd like to resolve, you develop a deliberative body and give it some political power, some you know, authority in the end, but that you choose those people around that issue, not necessarily for a position like mayor or president, or would you?
No, that's exactly right. So on the full version, as I argue for it, you'd replace Congress entirely and instead have 20 different sort of single issue legislative bodies focused on different areas. So transportation, education, health, you know, these divide things by area and then have randomly chosen citizens selected to serve as a legislative body, but focus just on that topic. And they would replace Congress effectively. And for the executive, I'd get rid of the elected executive entirely. That's a separate chapter of the book. But yeah, I don't think you should pick, you know, a single person and give them all this power. I think that way lies disaster. But the basic idea is to shift from focusing on picking people and instead to thinking about what are our actual problems that we're facing and what might we do in response.
Yeah, but that's interesting because that addresses directly, I think, this whole question of scale. If we see the decisions we make based on the problems that we're feeling rather than on it's every 4 years and it's time for a new president, it becomes much more intimate in terms of our relationship and our engagement and breaks down the scale. It's not a nation, it's not a state or a city, it's this thing that's bothering me. So that, I think, then, I'd like to bring another voice into this conversation and talk about ways in which people have governed themselves under different assumptions, making different assumptions about the places where they live. Arwin Smallwood joins us now. Arwin Smallwood is a professor and chair of the History and Political Science Departments at North Carolina A&T State University. Arwin, welcome back.
I'm glad to be back. Thank you.
Let's talk with you about some of the issues that I think are fairly fascinating around, again, this question of governance. And that gets to the Tuscarora Nation and the matriarchy that, in a sense, held the nation together and became a kind of deliberative body over a group of tribes known vaguely as the Iroquois Nation. But tell us more about how that system worked.
Well, one of the things, I mean, the rest, everyone's been talking about, you know, things like integrity and transparency, fairness, and responsiveness. It's important to understand that early Native nations, particularly the Iroquois and more specifically the Tuscaroras, their governmental structure was based on family ties because everyone within the nation was literally related by blood. But there are some lessons to be learned there. Like if we talk in modern politics, all politics are local. And we talk about people are really still ultimately concerned about the everyday things that are happening in their communities and in their cities and towns. Most politics are local. But the system that existed amongst the Iroquois prior to European contact and even during their early contact basically was based on the clan mothers, which were the oldest women of rank, who would elect chiefs, you know, to basically represent them. And the basics of that government was that these mothers had seen these men, these young men, these young boys and eventually young men and older men grow and mature, and they knew their personalities. Anyone who's raised children know that each of their children has a unique and different personality. And they would select those people who had compassion and understanding about the conditions of others and cared about others. And so oftentimes would select these individuals to be their chiefs, to be their leaders. And one of the things that would happen, that leadership role, was that you could not accept the role unless you were willing to give up all your possessions. And that's quite amazing if you talk about politicians today and their net worth and our, you know, obsession with wealth. You know, you led the nation because you were willing to sacrifice for the members of the nation and do what was in the best interest of all the people of the nation. And so in that way, you had a government that was responsive, and it certainly had integrity, and there was no secrecy in the process in terms of who would be elected chief. It was done in council, and there was a consensus. Everyone agreed that this person, you know, has these characteristics that we need in a leader, and they would be a good leader.
And what's fascinating about this is that, forgive me for interrupting here, because I do want you to finish, but I want to sort of point out the fact that we're talking about a nation, and we mean that. This is initially five and ultimately six bands, tribes, separate tribes with their own sort of cultural backgrounds, but that were absolutely networked through clan and familial ties to become a nation known to them as the Haudenosaunee Confederation. It was called the Iroquois Nation by the European occupiers, but that you could maintain your integrity as a tribe, but understand your relationship to each other, and that this would be enforced by those who believed in networking and the way we come together and not the way we're falling apart, is the eye-popping thing about the success of this particular system, would you say?
Oh, yeah, without question, because although the five nations or six were the original founders of the Confederacy, or they were very much united, there were many other nations of Indians that ended up joining the Confederation, including the Delaware Indians, the Nanticoke Indians, the Maharans, the Nottoway Indians of Virginia, North Carolina, and on and on. I mean, there were multiple Indians in the Ohio Valley, the Miami Indians, who were part of the Confederation as well. So anyone could come into the Confederation, could become a part of the Confederation, and using the same basic system, they were responsible for their people. But again, through this confederation, they were united, you know, and so you have a large number of nations of Indians. And in fact, they even influenced the creation of what's called the Eastern Confederation, which was in New England. And the various nations that were there in New England confederated, you know, with the help of the Mohawks, basically following that model. But it was an early concept of, you know, you have sovereignty within your nation to govern your people within your nation in the way that you thought was best for them. But then you were collectively a part of the confederation in which you supported each other militarily and economically through trade, et cetera. And that maintained and kept the peace. And then you had a council that discussed issues that oftentimes could lead to war to try to sort those issues out before, you know, they, you know, eventually deteriorated into a armed conflict.
Yeah, and I think that's the fascinating thing about this, the recognition and the way in which this Confederacy navigated questions of local authority and local sovereignty, but understood that it was actually peace, right, that peace and tranquility that was going to benefit all of us. And so we had to find some sort of superstructure that would engender peace, not separation, which is, and this is a subtle point to me, Arwin, but it shows up in your work and in the investigation of this Confederacy, the subtle but important difference. We need to find out what draws us together. Unlike, you know, de Tocqueville bragging about them, these Americans, they know how to organize. They organize for their cause over and against the other cause, and separation becomes the thing that identifies this particular, our system, over and against the other one that says, no, we're all in this together, and we have to find some way to find to not fight and solve these differences. Is that a good characterization, or am I way off on that, Arwin?
No, I think that's a good characterization. I think that over the last couple of years, one of the things we've gotten away from is the understanding that we all, you know, really desire the same things. We all want, you know, a quality education for our children. We all want, you know, a safe community. We all want economic prosperity, or, you know, however we perceive prosperity to be. And I think that in recent years, we have demonized each other. The different parties have demonized each other. And we've failed to see, you know, the common interest and also the common good. I also refer back to the Iroquois and the Klan mothers and their decisions to make chiefs or elect chiefs, that the decisions that they made, one, had to be through consensus. In other words, they looked at each side and all the different, you know, issues that affected people and came to a consensus, to an agreement that this is what's in the best interest, you know, of the nation. But more importantly, the decisions that they made were not for themselves. They were not for themselves, for their parents, or even their children or grandchildren. But every decision that was made had the seventh generation in mind. Hmm. Future generations. What we do today, how is it going to impact, you know, seven generations from now?
Well, I'm going to keep you on the line. We have to take a break right now, but I want to come back to this conversation with Arwin Smallwood, professor of history and political science at Carolina A&T, and also want to talk with Alex Guerrero and Rosemary Blizzard, all on the state of things as we examine alternatives to our current electoral process. The conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Well, most of us have heard embarrassing statistics about American ignorance. Only something like 23% of registered American voters can find Iran on a map. But we also don't want to set the bar too high for our elected officials, who we can't expect to be experts on everything. Now, here's former governor of New Mexico in the 2016 Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson.
What would you do if you were elected about Aleppo?
About?
Aleppo.
And what is Aleppo?
You're kidding.
No.
Aleppo is in Syria. It's the epicenter of the refugee crisis.
Okay, got it. Got it.
Okay.
Lessons learned. So here we go. Ignorance is not the only symptom of our electoral system, but it certainly is widespread and crossing plenty of party lines. And yet we continue to vote and we continue to have great faith in our process. We have with us three people who can shed some light on alternatives to our system. Rosemary Blizzard is communications director at the Ranked Choice Voting Resource Center. Alex Guerrero is an associate professor of philosophy at Rutgers University. And Arwin Smallwood is a professor and chair of the History and Political Science Departments at North Carolina A&T State University. Arwin, we were talking about the Haudenosaunee, otherwise known as the Iroquois Confederation, and the ways in which that confederation was worked and held together through a matriarchy. Talk again about the importance of the clan networks and the idea, because you talked before the break about the fact that people knew they were not doing it for themselves but for future generations. The idea that we are linked through bloodlines, all of us together, though we're in different clans, was an important part of the thinking and the way the system worked, was it not?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, in our society, even today, we still function this way. I mean, the group that we really, you know, owe our allegiances to and that we are most worried about and concerned about are our families, right? So you start with your family unit, right? And then from the family unit, it's your neighbors, you know, your community, right? And you share, you know, a common set of values and you live in a common area. And then from there, it branches out to your county or, you know, your city, your town, your county, and of course, eventually your state. And so in these early governmental structures and Native societies were pretty much the same. They started with the family. One of the differences, though, was that Native families were extended, which meant that there were, you know, not just the children and the parents of those children living in a household, but the grandparents, you know, the parents' parents, and sometimes great-grandparents. And so, and if the children were of age, you know, grandchildren and great-grandchildren. So they had longhouses, what were called longhouses, and these were large residential structures in which multiple generations lived in the same structure. And so where our society today is nuclear, you have nuclear families. People, you know, when the kids reach a certain age, they go to college or go off to work and get married and have their own families. Well, obviously, if you have that kind of a structure, you have a generational structure in a household, you know, then, you know, you have the wisdom of the older people who have lived through and seen quite a few things. And you have, you know, those people who are currently in the struggle trying to survive, but they have the help of the older people to raise their children and raise them, you know, a certain way. And then you see the young people, you have the young children there, you know, who are, you know, developing under the tutelage of both their parents as well as their grandparents, and in many cases, even great-grandparents. And so in that way, again, that structure is very, you know, much, you know, a very community-based structure, family-based structure that then expands out to the larger nation. But everyone within that community, people care about. And just to, you know, not to consume too much time, I would say that being a North Carolinian, someone who was born and raised here and whose roots go back hundreds of years here, I would say that many North Carolinians traditionally have had that kind of value structure. I mean, when we talk about our schools, we talk about our roads, we talk about our, you know, the infrastructure. I mean, people have collectively worked together to build the current state of North Carolina that we're in. There were generations before, my parents' generation and my grandparents' generations, who helped to lay the foundation for the educational and economic systems that we have. And those values, I think, are really well ingrained in quite a few North Carolinians. So again, you know, the Tuskegee, this is their homeland, of course, and a great many people are influenced in many ways that they don't really understand and know. But some of that essence is there. Yes, we've gotten, you know, caught in this dual political system, you know, Democrat or Republican, and people are battering each other. But at the core of people, I think that, you know, we all want the same thing.
Well, we do. And I guess that's the nucleus of this conversation, which is how do we translate those things that we understand to be our issues into through a process? How does that get reflected and expressed through a process that may in many ways distort even the question that we're trying to ask, that when the question itself doesn't address the issues that are important to me and the candidates themselves are able to talk about things that don't, how do we do that systemically? So let me go back to some of those systems. Rosemary Blizzard, talk about ranked choice voting. We talked about, you know, the Tuscarora system, obviously land ownership, boundaries, everything is very different in terms of how these nations are constructed. So maybe that kind of consensus building can work there and not necessarily in our society. Do you see ranked choice voting as sort of working toward a more consensus-oriented kind of decision-making?
I think it can. As Arwen was talking, you know, and I'm guilty of this as well as I think all of us are on some level. You know, we talk about, I've got concerns about my children's education, my roads, my infrastructure. We've got to get back to saying our roads, our infrastructure, the education of our children. And with ranked choice voting, what that sort of puts candidates in the position of doing is voters can look at them very clearly and say, I don't have to pick one of you over the other, but I do have to know where you sit and you sit in relation to the questions that we need to answer. And so I need the candidates to tell me, where are you on the spectrum, so that I can put those candidates in the choice order that will help me get the information that I need about the issues that are important to all of us.
It also suggests to me, because certainly a political analyst will take a look at voting results and they'll see what the candidates were saying, see what kind of votes they got, and then reframe and reshape their issues and their positions based on those results. Now, if you have two candidates, two frameworks for understanding things, everything from that moment forward is going to be shaped that way. And if none of it was speaking to me, then I've got a bad election coming up in 4 years again. Whereas what you're suggesting here is there's more subtlety and nuance in the way these candidates are framing things. My analysis is going to have to be much more subtle, and the way I frame issues might be a little better tailored to what people were actually saying if they got to choose among four or five candidates than just two.
And also keep in mind as well, if I am a candidate who wins a ranked choice voting election and wins with over 50% of the vote, then not only do I come away from that as, wow, over 50% of the people like me, but I also have to keep in mind that 50%, not 30%, or some of the other margins we see elected at this point, I'm indebted to that 50%, and that's a far bigger group of people that can hold me to task than if we elect people with 30%.
Now, Alex, when we're talking about lottery, we kind of come the other way around, right? We have people who are put in office not because they've declared a position, but because they've declared or maybe were impressed into a willingness to engage this issue and find out what people are thinking and find out what the issue is.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I think part of it, getting back to things both Rosemary and Arwin have said, you know, we need to think about how the system is either helping or hurting us feel like a community where we're in it together rather than being at each other's throats. So I think there's a way of running elections, and that's the way we're running them now, I think, that really creates division and makes us feel like enemies, where we vilify those on the other side. And, you know, I think this taps into deep-seated things about us, the kind of in-group, out-group dynamic. So a lot of the, you know, experts who study this kind of thing talk about social identity theory, and, you know, the political scientists say our partisan identities have become these kind of mega identities that drive our thinking and values about everything. And that really is corrosive for solving problems together, which is ultimately, you know, what we want our political system to do for us. And I think, you know, ranked choice voting really helps, approval voting, these systems that try to create consensus and build collaboration rather than us versus them, where it's a kind of death fight. You know, whoever wins gets to lord it over the other side for 4 years. I mean, that's not a way to run a country. One other thing I want to pick up on that Arwin mentioned is the kind of long-term thinking. And I think elections, again, really incentivize getting us to think very short-term in ways that I feel like should trouble us. So if climate change is something we all face, we don't want people just thinking at a 2 or 4 year time horizon. I think with random selection, people could really think in a broader way.
Well, it also suggests, too, getting back to this issue of scale, whether or not we're addressing the issues that really mean something to me. I can be frightened about, you can scare me into thinking that there's something going on at my border that might threaten me. But if I don't actually feel that threat and it's not an issue and you make it an issue, that seems to me the challenge of our system versus a lottery system, which says, let's vote on the things that we care about at the moment. And we should have eyes all over the nation to alert us to things that we might be worried about that aren't within our frame of reference. Seems to me we might be more effective and less prone to fear about things that really don't matter.
That's true. And you get people from all walks of life actually making policy. So you get, you know, single parents and people on government benefits and people who don't have stable housing. All of a sudden, these are people who are also in the serious political conversation. And I think that changes things, too. We'll shift what we're focused on, and we won't focus on these kind of distracting culture war things that really aren't our main issues, but they're good at dividing us.
Have we gone too far, though? I mean, I'm wondering, because so much of our own persona, right, our persons, our egos are now invested in. We've been trained psychologically to become our political views. Can we really leave that and not face some form of psychological annihilation? Are we actually ready to go back to a more humane system, or could we not handle it at this point?
I mean, I think many of us are ready for that. I mean, you know, Thanksgiving is coming up. Many of us don't get along with our families in the same way that, you know, we might have because of politics. And I think that's sad. You know, that's a tragic thing where this is dividing us rather than being something where we come together and work to solve problems. I feel like most people find it dissatisfying to be so afraid of and so angry at the people on the other side. Like, that's not a healthy way to live. I think we're ready for change. I mean, both Trump and Sanders in 2016 were running on a message of the system doesn't work for you. It doesn't work for people like you. We need to change it. You know, we haven't seen some of those changes materials. I think they run deeper than any candidate. I think they're systemic.
Well, Rosemary, let's talk about whether the kind of the same question, but framed slightly differently, which is what kind of pushback do you get from people, or how receptive, put it another way, are they to your suggestion of ranked choice voting, something that seems very different? Are people ready for it?
I think so. We've seen Maine use ranked choice voting for the first time in 2018 on a federal, congressional election, excuse me. And then again, they used it just this past November for president for the first time in our history. And it looks like Alaska is going to pass a similar measure. We're still waiting for the final votes on that. So it's creeping along, especially at the municipal level. There are dozens of cities across the nation that are either using ranked choice voting or in the process of implementing it for their municipal elections. So I think we're ready. You know, we've looked at, talked to voters after the fact, after they have participated in a ranked choice voting election, and overwhelmingly, they find it easy to do. They like it. They, and, you know, have a very positive opinion of it. And when I say overwhelmingly, I'm talking in 70 and 80% approval ratings. Mm. And, you know, when was the last time any of us, 80% of us, have ever agreed on anything? I don't get that kind of traction at home trying to pick dinner, and there's just four of us. So,
well, let me ask Arwin Smallwood a question right along those lines, because we've heard from you, Rosemary, and Alex, both suggesting that we as individuals, as people of the United States of America, we're ready for some kind of a change. But institutionally, and I'll address this question to you, Arwin, as a political scientist, what are some of the other barriers institutionally from those people who hold office, the corporations, the donors that have invested in this system? How much resistance would they have to change, and how effective would that resistance be?
That's a very difficult question. I mean, I agree with everyone. I think that, you know, people are ripe for change. They're ready for change. I think we all have, you know, the pandemic and everything that's been going on, I think everyone's kind of exhausted, and that's across the board in academia as well as government and just regular people. And I actually, you know, and I hope I'm answering this, but what I think is that one of the things that we have seen happen, unfortunately, is that people, I think, have begun to lose an understanding of each other. We're just talking about families and, you know, and how, you know, you can't have a conversation politically in the family. But I do believe, because of the rapid urbanization of America, that we have, you know, there is a urban-rural divide. And I think that, in a sense, it's almost like sending people abroad to study abroad. I think that we really internally as a nation, we need to start going back to different communities. I mean, rural dwellers need to experience the city in a different way, and urban dwellers need to go back to the farm and experience rural life and understand what rural people are going through. I think that we have evolved in such a way in which people don't remember and don't understand. Coming from a rural environment, I fully remember it and embrace it and have family members who still live there. And then I've gone through an urban environment and lived in major cities. And so I understand that environment as well. But, you know, a lot of people have migrated from their farms and their rural communities to cities and have a different way of life. So I don't know that I'm answering your question, but I think it begins with, I'm a believer in education, always going to be a believer in education. We don't have to agree, but we can understand each other, and we understand each other through education.
Arwin Smallwood, well, I'm going to break it off there because I'm just out of time, but I do appreciate your contribution. Arwin Smallwood, professor and chair of history and political science at North Carolina A&T State University. Rosemary F. Blizzard is communications director for Ranked Choice Voting Resource Center and a former director for the Wayne County and Duplin County Boards of Elections. And Alex Guerrero, associate professor of philosophy at Rutgers University. His forthcoming book is Lautocracy, A New Kind of Democracy. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.